Welcome back to the Deep Dive. So, if you're feeling anything like us, maybe a bit exhausted, just navigating this constant stream of management trends and these really abstract leadership ideas.
Yeah, there's so much out there.
Right. They all seem to promise this deep clarity, but, you know, often it feels like you just get surface level definitions.
Mm.
If that sounds familiar, well, this deep dive is definitely for you.
Mm.
Today, we're really trying to move beyond just the theory. We're tackling a system. And honestly, it makes one of the boldest claims I think we've ever encountered in the source material.
That's a big one.
It doesn't just call itself a framework. It claims to be a loving constitution of human intelligence.
And that distinction, that phrase, it's absolutely crucial. It really sets the stage for everything else. Our mission today, really, is to unpack this awakened leadership model and philosophy.
Which was pioneered by Sandeep Mehra, we should note.
Yes, exactly. And we have to get right to the core of it. Like you said, the material insists this isn't just, you know, borrowed intellect. It's not another philosophy pieced together from other theories. It's defined very specifically as remembered human intelligence.
Right. Remembered human intelligence. Mm. That's a profound idea. Let's unpack that claim because it does feel like a big leap.
It is.
When we talk about remembered human intelligence, we're kind of moving away from the usual models, right? Like traditional education or even just learning on the job.
Mm-hmm.
What fundamentally separates this remembered intelligence from, say, insight you gain through experience or study?
Well, think of it as the difference between extracting something versus acknowledging something that's already there.
Okay. Extraction versus acknowledgement.
Exactly. So traditional leadership often relies heavily on intellectualism, right? You study case studies, you borrow theories, you crunch data from past results. You're extracting knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
But the sources defining awakened leadership, or AL, they insist this deeper clarity, this innate intelligence, is already alive. It's within us as individuals. It's within our systems, our societies, even within nations.
So it's not something you get. It's something you uncover or remember, like the name says.
Precisely. It's an intelligence that, in a way, can't really be learned or taught conventionally. It can only be acknowledged, remembered, and then actively awakened.
So it's like a pre-existing clarity.
Yes. As opposed to the kind of intellectual borrowing that, let's be honest, often just leads to surface fixes, doesn't it? Not that deep foundational alignment.
Okay, so if this wisdom, this intelligence is already present, whether it's in the leader or the system itself,
mm-hmm.
then the purpose of this awakened leadership model isn't really to inject new information.
No.
It's more about providing a mechanism, maybe a bridge, to kind of realign with that innate truth that's already there.
That's exactly how the materials frame it. Awakened leadership is that essential bridge. And its scope, well, it's huge.
Right.
It's designed, they say, to hold balance across these massive, often historical tensions. Think about the tension between civilizations and nations.
Yeah.
Between effective governance and what societies actually need. And critically, between the forces that drive conflict and, you know, the genuine possibilities for lasting peace.
So this bridge, it aims to restore purpose to power and clarity to leadership.
Yes, exactly. Foundational clarity across the board. It connects that inner alignment, the leader's own centeredness, with the very practical, very real responsibilities demanded by global systems.
Okay, that really sets the stage perfectly for digging into this first big idea.
Yeah.
Why call it a living constitution? I mean, a framework gives you structure, right? A model gives you steps. But a constitution that implies something foundational, almost permanent. It suggests a governing soul.
Mm.
How does AL, according to the sources, earn that title?
Well, it earns it through its fundamental purpose, which is stated very clearly, to restore clarity, purpose, and alignment. And not just anywhere, but in every sphere of human life. That ambition makes it foundational, not just a guide.
So it's the universality of its intended application.
That and its depth. The materials lay out these three inseparable layers that really define this constitutional nature. And they exist in a kind of hierarchy, a hierarchy of depth.
Okay, let's break those layers down. We need to understand what gives it movement, what keeps it grounded,
right,
and what provides that soul you mentioned.
Right. So starting at the level of action, the most visible part we have. Number one, the model.
Okay.
This is that spiral of 4+1 steps we'll get into. Accept, see, unite, shift, and the key one, improvise. This is the process you see. It gives the movement the dynamic rhythm of awakening.
Got it. The how-to in motion.
Then number two, there's the framework. This is the set of four anchors. These are the practical grounding elements. And they make sure that the movement, the spiral, stays embodied. It stays connected to reality.
Anchors. keeps it from flying off into theory land.
Exactly. And then the third layer, the deepest one, the Constitution itself.
Ah.
This isn't the model or the framework. It's the living intelligence that holds both of them. It's not some static document you read in a manual.
Yeah.
It's something that's remembered in presence, embodied in action. This is what provides the soul, the enduring truth that runs through the whole system.
Okay, let me see if I've got this. The model is the rhythm of what you actually do. The framework is how you stay grounded while you're doing it.
Mm-hmm.
And the Constitution, that's the ultimate soul, the sort of remembered clarity that ensures the whole process is authentic, aligned with truth.
You've got it. And this structure, this layering, forces us to make a really critical distinction about philosophy itself.
Right, because the name is Awakened Leadership Model and Philosophy.
Exactly. But the sources are very careful here. They stress that philosophy is only one instrument, just one vessel, you could say, through which this living human intelligence flows and communicates.
So the philosophy isn't the core intelligence itself?
No. The philosophy is the expression of awakening. It's how it talks, how it explains itself. Mm-hmm. But it's not the abstract intellectual theory itself. If we just treat it like another abstract theory, we risk shrinking that living constitution right back down into just another static framework. We lose the living part.
That's a really important clarification. But does raise a practical point. If this model claims to be a living constitution for, you know, global systems, it needs to apply everywhere, right? So if philosophy is just one instrument, what are the other ways? What are the practical channels this remembered intelligence uses to actually touch something like, say, governance or technology?
That's the proof of its constitutional nature. Its application across literally every dimension of human activity. The sources detail a whole suite of specific practical channels, and they're all seen as expressions of that same constitutional soul.
Okay, like what?
Well, we see awakened governance, which is applied at the national level. Then there's awakened global governance, focusing on international relations, cooperation. There's awakened political governance, which gets specific about the political machinery itself.
Interesting.
And very relevant today, awakened AI governance, tackling the huge ethical and, frankly, existential challenges of AI, and also awakened diplomacy, aimed squarely at international resolution.
Wow. Awakened AI governance. That feels incredibly timely. Including the tech domain really anchors this model in today's reality, doesn't it? It's tackling one of the biggest systemic challenges where, let's face it, ethical frameworks are really hard to create and even harder to enforce.
Absolutely. And it shows the breadth of the claim. They also mention a specific tool, the Awakened Leadership Compass tool, as another practical mechanism.
Okay.
So the big takeaway here, the really profound point, is that this living constitution isn't meant to be confined to a book or a lecture hall. It's designed to manifest through this coherent, interconnected set of tools and applications across government, tech, international relations, basically aiming to deliver clarity right into the systems that are often overwhelmed by complexity.
It really does sound like it's tried to be a complete operating system for clarity within complexity.
That's a great way to put it.
Like a declaration of independence from all that inherited dysfunction we see everywhere. Okay, let's move on now. Let's look at the architecture of this operating system, the 4+1 steps that actually create the movement.
Okay, so as we transition here, just remember what we said. The model provides the rhythm. And this rhythm, it's not linear. The sources really emphasize this. It breathes in a spiral.
A spiral, not a straight line.
Right. So leadership isn't about executing these steps once and you're done. It's about returning, going deeper each time. It ensures this continuous renewal. It's framed as a perpetual rhythm of remembrance, definitely not a finite project plan with a start and end date.
And that makes sense because systems are always changing, reality is always shifting. A linear model wouldn't keep up. But you mentioned earlier, the spiral rhythm needs grounding. It can't just spin off into abstraction.
Exactly. It needs to be anchored.
And those were the four anchors of the framework. We need to really detail those now, I think. What are they?
Yes, absolutely. The Awakened Leadership Framework provides these four critical anchors. They root the spiral firmly in human intelligence and in reality. They stop it from becoming just theoretical.
Okay, the four anchors.
First is inner vision. This provides the why. It's about the unwavering commitment to alignment, to clarity, the deep sense of purpose.
Right, the internal compass.
Second, heart center alignment. This is what ensures the leader acts with integrity. It connects that vision to emotional intelligence, to genuine empathy. It's about leading from a place of wholeness.
Vision plus integrity.
Third is life's essence. This is about the deep, innate purpose of the entity, whether it's the leader, the organization, or even a nation. What truly defines its existence beyond just, say, material gain or status.
A core identity.
And fourth, crucially, is materiality.
Right.
This grounds the whole process in the tangible world. It means the clarity, the vision, the alignment it must translate into embodied action, into measurable results, sustainable systems. The movement has to touch the ground, make a real difference.
That distinction feels absolutely key. Without materiality, like you said, it's just nice ideas. But without inner vision, there's no direction. These anchors really do seem designed to keep the spiral honest, keep it real. Okay, let's dive into the steps themselves, the spiral movement, starting where, arguably, all real change has to begin. Step one, accept.
Acceptance, yes, the zero point, you could say, of awakening. The action here is really about standing firmly, squarely in the present moment.
Just being here, now.
Yes, but actively, released from the heavy baggage of the past, all the legacy burdens, the historical grievances, the should-haves, and also released from those paralyzing anxieties about the future, the what-ifs.
Easier said than done, especially for established systems.
Oh, absolutely. But the result of this action, this acceptance, is critical. It immediately starts to dissolve the illusion of control.
Ooh, the illusion of control. That's often the hardest thing for any entrenched system to let go of, isn't it? Especially nations or big organizations with long histories of success, they often cling so tightly to the idea that the control mechanisms that worked before will keep working now.
Exactly right. Think about a big, successful company leader who just refuses to accept that their entire legacy business model is maybe becoming obsolete because of new technology.
A denial.
That refusal, that lack of acceptance of reality is what completely blocks any real forward movement. The sources describe acceptance here as a kind of surrender, but they're very quick to emphasize it is not defeat.
Okay, important distinction. Surrender, not defeat.
It's surrender to one's true purpose. So for a nation, maybe that's accepting its real role and responsibility on the global stage, not the one it wishes it had. For an individual, accepting their inner calling beyond some borrowed identity or a burden they've put on themselves.
So it releases energy.
Yes, it releases all the energy that was being used to hide the present moment, to fight reality. And the result is clarity, not collapse. You see things as they are.
And presumably, only once that acceptance is really active, really alive, can a leader or a system move to the second step, which is step two. See? Because if I'm still clinging to that old story, that old illusion of control, everything I look at is going to be distorted by that bias, right?
Seeing is literally impossible if acceptance isn't there. You're looking through a filter. So this step, see, it demands perception that is as free from bias as possible. It's about discerning what truly aligns with the system's clarity, its purpose, and what fundamentally misaligns.
It's not just passive looking.
No, definitely not passive observation. It requires active discernment. The leader, the system, has to analyze the truth in motion, what parts need to remain, what needs to fundamentally transform, and importantly, what needs to dissolve entirely because it just doesn't serve that core constitutional purpose anymore.
So if acceptance is kind of the emotional and intellectual surrender to reality, seeing is the active diagnostic phase,
mm-hmm.
where you really assess the situation clearly.
Yes, it's the active recognition of truth in motion. That's a key phrase from the sources. It's the point where awakening shifts from being just an internal state, okay, I accept, to active engagement. Okay, now I discern based on that acceptance.
Right.
And this ability to see clearly without the filters, that's the doorway. That's what informs everything that comes next. If a nation, for example, is crippled by some internal contradiction, seeing is the act of naming that contradiction truthfully without trying to deflect or spin it.
Okay. Seeing the truth, naming it. Once that clarity of vision is established, presumably we move towards integration. Which brings us to step three. Unite. Seeing reveals the fragments, the misalignments. So uniting must be about restoring coherence.
Unite is exactly that. It's the restoration phase. It's about gathering up that clarity you gain from seeing, gathering the core values, the vision, and bringing it all together into a unified, coherent whole. It's the synthesis stage, yes. Where contradictions that maybe seemed paralyzing before start to soften, where scattered efforts within, say, an organization or a government department start to become a shared ecosystem,
mm-hmm.
everybody rowing in the same direction aligned with the same core purpose.
This sounds like it applies directly to breaking down silos in organizations.
Absolutely.
If the leadership is coherent, if it's unified in its direction, if the CEO's vision actually aligns with what the supply chain manager is trying to do, and that aligns with the diplomat's strategy,
mm-hmm.
then the whole system moves as one.
It transforms those fragmented parts into one living, synchronized whole. And it's grounded, remember, in those four anchors. Vision, heart center, essence, materiality.
So the result is coherence in direction.
Community and movement, and this deep inner anchoring in purpose. And when that unifying force becomes active, it dramatically reduces friction within the system, which naturally allows for the next step to actually happen.
Which is step four, shift. Mm-hmm. This sounds like where the change becomes tangible. Translating that inner alignment into actual outer reality.
Shift is the movement from misalignment into orbit. That's the language used. Every part of the system, whether it's an individual, a department, a government policy, finds its true position relative to the whole, and it synchronizes. It's the moment that inner constitutional intelligence manifests externally, visibly.
Okay, I want to challenge this a bit, or at least explore it. In our world, everything's about speed, right? Fast pivots, rapid change. When I hear shift, I think quick. Does the model push for speed here, or is it something different?
That's a great question, and the sources are incredibly explicit on this point. Shift is not primarily about speed. It is fundamentally about rhythm.
Rhythm, okay.
When the shift happens correctly, the leadership becomes movement itself. And that movement, that sort of effortless synchronization, that is the undeniable signal of awakening. So think of it less like a frantic, fast pivot and more like a gravitational adjustment, an entire system smoothly moving into its proper synchronous orbit.
So the focus is on finding the right rhythm for that system, which would naturally be sustainable, unlike just forcing speed for speed's sake.
Exactly. The right rhythm is always sustainable. Force speed usually leads to burnout or breakdown.
Okay, so we have the four foundational steps. Accept, see, unite, shift. A clear progression.
Yeah.
But you mentioned the genius lies in the 4+1 structure. There's a fifth, master step.
Yes. Step five, improvise the master step. This is described as the master key. It's what prevents the model from ever becoming just a rigid static formula.
How so?
Improvisation ensures the model stays dynamic, totally adaptable, alive in every single nanosecond of reality. It continuously renews itself. It allows leadership to step beyond the formula when needed and become, in a sense, infinite in its responsiveness.
Okay, but how does improvisation work in a massive system, like a government or a huge multinational corporation? Does it just mean leaders start going off script all the time?
It means going with the script of reality, not just a pre-written plan. I think of it like water. Improvisation naturally finds and fills the exact gaps in clarity or alignment wherever they appear. It ensures continuous renewal through reception, taking in what's really happening, and revelation allowing the right response to emerge. And crucially, it means a leader or a system doesn't necessarily have to cycle through all four preceding steps in order every single time.
Right. So if a system is, say, pretty good at accepting and seeing reality, but it's struggling with unification.
Exactly. Improvisation allows it to adapt and deliver precisely what's missing at that moment. It strengthens the weak link with almost surgical focus without redoing the parts that are already working.
Okay, so it acts as a mechanism for precision targeting within the spiral. A system can kind of enter the flow wherever needed, and improvisation tailors the response.
Precisely. It's this capacity for instantaneous, relevant, gap-filling precision that really liberates leadership into rhythm. It ensures the model avoids that rigidity that plagues so many established theories and frameworks. It allows the system to be perpetually self-correcting and, well, alive.
All right, so we've got the architecture, that's the 4+1 model. We've got the grounding, the four anchors. Now we really need to address the heart of it all, the soul, which you identified as the philosophy.
Mm.
This philosophy, you said, is what ensures these steps remain a living, breathing rhythm and don't just become mechanical motions.
Yes. And we absolutely have to reiterate that foundational truth here again. This philosophy, as presented, is not something constructed by human intellect. It wasn't stitched together from studying historical theories.
Right.
It's defined as human intelligence flowing in expression, like a natural current of awakening, unfiltered. And that is what transforms a practical framework into a genuine living constitution. It gives it its soul.
And the sources, they connect this inherent nature, this soul, directly to Sandeep Mehra's upcoming work, don't they? Something called the 111 Rule of Being Human, which seems to focus on core human traits, things machines can't replicate.
That's right. And this philosophy embodies those core traits. The sources highlight three core signals, three defining tenets of the philosophy, which really mark out the territory of truly human, non-mechanical leadership.
Okay. What are those three signals?
They are, first, paradox. The ability of leadership to hold contradiction without collapsing under the strain.
Hold contradiction.
Second, remembrance. The capacity for leadership to recall its own innate alignment, its own truth, instead of constantly borrowing or importing external doctrines or fleeting trends.
Remembering its own core.
And third, presence. The commitment of leadership to act from what is actually real in this moment, completely free from the paralysis of past failures or, you know, the fantasy of future projections.
Okay, let's dig into paradox a bit more, because honestly, modern governance, modern organizations, they often seem desperate to simplify complexity, right? To find the single answer. Yet this ale philosophy says the real strength lies in holding the complexity itself. Why is holding paradox so non-negotiable for awakened leadership?
Because, fundamentally, to be human is to carry paradox. It's inherent in us. We live with contradiction, with duality all the time. So if a leader tries to deny that or erase the contradiction, maybe they have two competing essential stakeholder needs and they try to just pick one and ignore the other, they're actually denying reality.
They're creating a false simplicity.
Exactly. The awakened leader, guided by this philosophy, sees the ability to hold both truths simultaneously without being destroyed by that tension as a profound strength. It's where creativity and synthesis emerge. For a nation, you mentioned complexity. It might mean embracing both fiercely individualistic rights and a deep sense of shared community responsibility. The awakened leader doesn't feel forced to choose sides. They look for the synthesis, the way to hold both.
That leads nicely into remembrance. You know, in our globalized world, it's so common for nations, for organizations to import best practices or try to emulate successful models from somewhere else. How does this idea of recalling one's own alignment fit into that reality? Seems almost countercultural.
It is a bit countercultural to the borrow everything mindset. Remembrance is positioned as the antidote to just constantly borrowing intellect. It means that the leader, or the organization, or the nation, recalls its own constitutional truth, its unique life's essence, going back to the framework anchors.
Its own fingerprint, almost.
Yes. Instead of blindly adopting external doctrines that might actually contradict its internal reality or its history, it acts from its specific, unique alignment. So, for a country, this could mean ensuring its governance structures genuinely arise from its own soil, its own culture, its own history, not just a generic template dropped in from outside.
And for a corporation.
It means remembering its core value proposition, its original spark, and staying true to that purpose, even when market fads are pushing it in a different direction. It's about authenticity rooted in identity.
Okay. And the third signal, presence. Acting from what is real in this moment. Now, that sounds simple, deceptively simple, perhaps, but how does it actually manifest in really high-stakes situations like complex political negotiations or major corporate decisions?
Presence is that active engagement with the now, completely divorced from the emotional weight of yesterday's trauma or tomorrow's projected fear. Think about a high stakes scenario. So many decisions get driven by protecting the ego based on past mistakes. Oh, we can't fail like we did last quarter.
Right. Fear of repeating the past.
Or by future anxieties. If we don't scale this insanely fast, we're going to lose market share. An awakened leader operating from presence acts purely from the clarity of the present reality. What is true right now? What is needed right now?
So their actions become traceable to truth, not ego.
Exactly. Traceable to clarity rather than ego or defensiveness or wishful thinking. And that presence ensures the decision is more likely to be sustainable and truly aligned because it's based on reality, not fear or fantasy.
So the philosophy really does act as the soul, ensuring those 4+1 steps remain this breathing human rhythm. And because this core intelligence, this soul, flows through all those different instruments you mentioned, awakened diplomacy, political governance, AI governance, it ensures that soul can potentially touch every single dimension of human life, from me as an individual right up to global governing bodies.
That's the idea. They are all conduits for the same unified, remembered human intelligence. The scope is intended to be total, which logically brings us to maybe the most compelling part.
Right.
The proof. Where does this actually show up? The embodiment.
Right. Because the true test of any system, especially one claiming constitutional status, has got to be its practical application. Does it work? The sources really hammer this point. Embodiment is the proof. It's not just theory to read about. It has to be a living reality that gets activated. So where do we actually see this constitutional clarity manifesting, or where is it intended to manifest in the real world?
Yeah, the rubber has to meet the road. The model needs to demonstrate its utility across every scale of human organization. Let's start big. Governance and nations.
Okay. In governance, we often feel trapped in these cycles, don't we? Where temporary political power dictates long-term policy, often based on ideology or winning the next election. How does awakened leadership even begin to break that cycle?
Well, the argument in the sources is that when AL principles are truly embodied in governance, policies start to fundamentally outlast the politics of the moment.
No.
Because they're built on that deeper constitutional clarity. They're built on the true needs of the nation. That's the remembrance piece, rather than just temporary power games, shifting ideological agendas, or those very short electoral cycles.
So policies get designed for the nation's rhythm, not the election's speed.
Beautifully put, yes. And for nations, the ultimate potential benefit is regaining foundational trust, which, the sources argue, can only happen when leadership genuinely surrenders to constitutional truth and alignment, instead of just serving the narrow interests of a few or the politically powerful factions.
That surrender to truth sounds exactly like that first step, except, but applied at a national scale. It takes real courage, I imagine, for a political system to let go of its self-serving interests in favor of that deeper alignment.
It absolutely does. And this clarity, this national clarity, is meant to translate directly onto the global stage through awakened diplomacy. Think about a typical diplomatic negotiation. So often, it feels rooted in domination, doesn't it? Parties trying to win, to maximize their gain.
Yes, zero-sum thinking.
Awakened diplomacy aims to shift that dialogue entirely towards resolution, towards synthesis. The goal becomes the coherence. Remember step three, unite. The coherence of the global ecosystem, rather than just maximizing individual national advantage at the expense of others.
And what about the pursuit of peace? It often feels so fragile, like a bargaining chip that gets traded away.
Well, under this model, peace isn't a bargaining chip. It's pursued as an absolute necessity, almost like a constitutional mandate for humanity. It's not just a performance metric you track or a temporary goal you achieve and then forget about.
So it's rooted in accepting our global interdependence.
Exactly. Rooted in the acceptance of that interdependence and the clarity that conflict fundamentally misaligns all parties involved from their true purpose and potential.
Okay, let's bring it down a level. Institutions and organizations. This is where it impacts most people's daily lives, right?
Yeah.
Corporate jobs, dealing with large bureaucracies. How does AL transform that often?
Mm.
Let's be honest, frustrating reality.
This is where you really see the potential fusion of that soul and the system. Bureaucracy, for instance, which so often hides inefficiency, sometimes even a lack of courage behind complicated procedures.
Yeah, we've always done it this way trap.
Right. That stops. Organizations, the sources say, stop functioning like empathy commentaries, you know, where they have these beautiful value statements on the wall, but fail to actually integrate them into how they operate day to day.
So systems start acting with responsibility as naturally as they act with efficiency.
That's the goal. For businesses, embodiment means genuinely aligning profit with purpose. Remember the life's essence anchor. Growth has to be tied to creating real value, building trust. It means keeping people and the larger collective ecosystem truly at the center, ensuring that the shift, the change, benefits humanity, not just the quarterly shareholder report.
That feels like a serious call to move way beyond just surface-level CSR, corporate social responsibility, and actually embed purpose deep into the system's DNA. Okay, now let's revisit the application we flagged earlier as critical, awakened AI governance and technology.
Yes, this application might be the most urgent proof point for why something like AL, with its constitutional depth, is needed now. As AI systems get exponentially smarter, faster, they still fundamentally lack those core human elements we talked about, the ones defined by that 1-1-1 rule, paradox, remembrance, and presence.
Machines can't hold paradox. They don't remember in the human sense. They don't have presence.
Exactly. So awakened leadership is positioned to step in and provide the essential ethical compass that the machines themselves simply cannot carry.
How does it provide that compass, though? Is it just about writing better regulations?
It's deeper than just regulation, according to the material. The key idea is that our governance and regulation for AI must arise from that remembered human intelligence. It needs the courage to serve creation, not just control it.
What do you mean, serve creation?
Well, if we regulate AI purely out of fear or a desire for absolute control, the resulting systems, the rules we create, will inevitably just reflect that fear and that control mindset.
Oh. Okay. The regulation mirrors the consciousness that created it.
Precisely. But if we regulate AI from a place of clarity about human purpose and with the courage to hold the paradox of this immense technological power, recognizing it can both create wonders and cause destruction, then the framework we build is more likely to serve creation, serve life, without sacrificing our essential humanity. AL provides the clarity, supposedly, to discern where human intuition, human values, those non-mechanical traits, must always retain the ultimate, say, the veto power over purely algorithmic efficiency.
So in essence, AL aims to ensure that even the most advanced, potentially soulless technology stays tethered to the soul of human purpose.
That's the core idea. And this same necessity, this same principle, trickles all the way down to individual leaders and societies. When it's embodied at the personal level, presence starts to replace the constant noise and distraction. Decisions become clearly traceable back to foundational clarity, not just ego reactions or emotional responses.
And goodness, morality. It's not borrowed.
Goodness, in this context, isn't seen as something borrowed from an external moral code, but something that is awakened from the leader's own internal alignment, their own heart center connection.
And central to all of this, both personally and systemically, seems to be this willingness to confront the messy stuff, the contradictions, including our own flaws.
Yes, absolutely essential. The need to acknowledge darkness, shadows. The philosophy is very clear on this. Leadership that refuses to recognize its own shadows, its blind spots, its historical failings, its capacity for self-interest, that leadership cannot stand fully in the light of its true purpose.
So it's not about pretending to be perfect.
You're not at all. Awakened leadership embraces the duality. It acknowledges the night, the difficult parts, the learning through failure, the night that teaches. And it acknowledges the day, the clarity, the purpose, the day that remembers. So the greatest proof of this model being embodied anywhere is visible wherever contradiction isn't denied, wherever paradox is lived without the system collapsing, and wherever duality is acknowledged honestly instead of being erased in favor of some false simplicity.
It really does sound like the highest expression of this model is a kind of leadership that's achieved this profound state of integration, able to navigate immense complexity without falling into the trap of reductionism. Hashtag tag outro.
That really is the ultimate takeaway, I think, from this deep dive. The awakened leadership model and philosophy pioneered by Sandeep Mehra, they're not being presented as just another style or a fleeting trend or even just a useful framework. They are positioned boldly as a living constitution of leadership, a dynamic, spiraling, perpetually alive system. And its purpose is clear: to restore clarity to individuals, teams, organizations, nations, systems drowning in complexity and often chaos.
It really is a system built to bridge those contradictions we talked about, drawing from this incredibly broad foundation that goes way beyond any single discipline. And unlike so many leadership theories that seem to demand simplification, this constitutional approach insists on holding paradox as a strength, seeing contradiction as part of the truth.
And it's dynamic, self-correcting, capable of improvisation, designed to be as alive as the universe it aims to lead within.
So the future of leadership, according to this specific philosophy, it doesn't belong to those just chasing influence or power in the traditional sense.
No. It belongs, they argue, to awakening, to that quiet inner strength that comes from discerning truth from illusion and then having the courage to carry that clarity into tangible systemic action.
So in that remembrance, leadership itself transforms. It stops being primarily a function of power.
And becomes instead a measure of clarity.
Clarity. A powerful shift. And so we'll leave you, our listeners, with that foundational, perhaps provocative thought that seems to encapsulate the whole healing essence of the system. Something that tries to redefine what it means to be human and what it means to lead. The night must be accepted for the day to be remembered.
Go forth. Seek your remembrance and lead alive.